This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 12th episode. For this episode, we will tackle an article in the JCNM examining the pediatric to adult transition period in type 1 diabetes and some of the factors associated with good control during that time. The inferential methods used in this paper are relatively unique, and looking closely at them will help us better understand their results. I have the privilege of hosting Endocrine Feedback Loop, working as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt in Nashville, where I also help direct the fellowship program. Two well-known diabetologists join me today for our discussion. Ashok Balasubramaniam is one of the regular contributors who is joining us today, coming to us from Baylor in Houston, where he is one of the vice presidents and associate deans at their medical school. He has held many important educational roles directing the endocrine fellowship and clinical scientist training programs at Baylor, as well as chairing the endocrinology specialty board for the ABIM. His research is translational in nature, focused on diabetes. Our guest expert today is Earl Hirsch from the University of Washington in Seattle. He is one of the world's experts in both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, with numerous articles to testify to his expertise and presentations to show how in demand he is as a speaker. So I couldn't have two better folks with whom to discuss today's article. As is always the case, everything we discuss today will be our opinions only and not those of the Endocrine Society or our respective institutions. Today, we look at improvement in A1C levels in early adulthood in the type 1 diabetes exchange, impact of racial, socioeconomic, and clinical factors. The first author is Alina Toski from the Joslin Diabetes Center and Harvard in Boston. Ashok, I'll now let you walk us through the introduction, highlighting points that the authors make, but also giving us an overview of some of the challenges in type 1 diabetes during this transition period. Ashok?
Thank you, Chase, and hello to you, and hello to Earl, and to all of you out there today. This is a really interesting article that touched off a lot of thinking on my part. I think the overall theme here is that we are now many decades out of the diabetes control and complications trial, and even though we kind of know what to do to get people under glycemic control, it's really hard to do that in real-life practice. And there are many factors that contribute to this. And we know a lot of trends. One trend is that glycemic control in children with type 1 diabetes tends to worsen during adolescence. And a number of cross-sectional studies have shown that glycemic control then tends to improve during young adulthood and then sort of plateaus at age 30. But this is, average data over large populations. And since many things about type 1 and type 2 diabetes are highly variable, in fact, there's a whole industry now around the heterogeneity of type 1 and type 2 diabetes, we need to understand why it is that different people have different rates of this deterioration, because it happens over a long period of time. And there are a lot of factors that contribute to this. And before I actually get into more of the introduction, I'd like to ask Earl, who is an expert here, can you sort of give us a brief overview, Earl, of some of the drivers that the paper actually talks about as contributing to this, these variations, race, SES, and so forth?
Sure. Well, thank you both for the opportunity to participate in this, I think, very important discussion. We have known for years that even though, as you say, Ashok, we know what needs to happen, that's not always what happens with our patients. This is very different than taking a statin or taking an ACE inhibitor because behavioral issues are involved. But it's even more complicated than just behavioral issues. There are cultural issues involved. And this brings everything involved in somebody's life to manage their diabetes. We've known, for example, that despite improvements in technology in the last 10 years, at least through the T1D exchange, we actually have seen a worsening of glycemic control in this adolescent and young adult age group. And yes, we have learned through the T1D exchange, and I have learned personally going through all of the papers that we have published, that ethnicity, socioeconomic status, level of education, diabetes self-management skills, and certainly diabetes technology are important, but it's even more complicated than that. We have learned in all of our studies that these surrogate outcomes are related to socioeconomic status and education. But I should also point out that mental health and the stressors that go along with what happens with people of this age group, even without diabetes, are important. And then the other thing to keep in mind when we think about minority populations, which we always think about when we look at populations, is that we know for a fact that on average, African Americans run hemoglobin A1Cs 0.4% higher for any given glucose. And it's my own personal opinion that from what I see here in Seattle, that number actually is a low estimate. It actually may be lower. And so we have to think about that when we think about these epidemiologic studies. I should also point out that we looked in the T1D exchange, both at pediatrics and adults. We didn't do a lot of looking at this population. And it actually becomes important for the study because the way the study was set up was there were pediatric study sites and there were adult study sites. And that actually, I think, is problematic that we didn't have as much mixing as I would have liked to. And then my final comment is this study is really looking at how things have evolved in the last 10 years. And I think the next 10 years are going to be more interesting due to the evolving of CGM as standard of care and automated insulin delivery. I think that's going to completely change how we look at this. And if this study is repeated 5 or 10 years from now, I think we may see different results.
That's wonderful, Earl, to get that perspective. And, you know, the study, which in fact originates within the type 1 diabetes exchange to which you referred, actually touches on all of those variables. And as you mentioned, some of those variables themselves change over time, right? So actually, this needs to be a work in progress. And I guess the key point, even before we get into the paper, is that it would be really helpful to have an idea of those variables in a real analysis, because some of those might be unchangeable, but some those that we can modify would be good for us to know so that we could actually improve the clinical practice and the outcomes with patients. And one of the problems which actually sort of sets the stage for this paper is that there has been a lack of data, especially longitudinal data. What data there is out there about this transition has been mostly cross-sectional. So longitudinal data would be very helpful, and that's what this paper is based on. And I guess you've already talked about how, you know, having such knowledge could really improve care. So this paper begins with a hypothesis that people in this transitional phase have distinct and different trajectories of glycemic control as measured by hemoglobin A1C. And there are a number of very specific demographic and clinical variables that affect these trajectories over time. And that's important, the longitudinal aspect of this. So I guess we could probably go into the methods. Chase, would you like to take over?
Yes, thank you. And thanks to you both, Ashok and Earl, for giving us already a really good overview of some of the challenges here, the lack of data, why we need to take a look at this, and really the potential for changing the care that we provide if we can understand a little bit better what's going on here. So what we're going to do is when we think about the methods, we're going to take just a little bit of a step back first and think about a few issues related to inferential methods here before we dive into the methods of this paper. And one thing that I thought would be helpful is because the methods used here are a little bit unique is to actually compare it to another study design that it is similar to help us understand it, and that's a case control study. So this paper is not truly a case control study, but it does have many features that are similar to it. And since case control studies are a little bit more well known and maybe a bit more accessible in how to understand them, I thought it would be helpful to think about that as a comparison point. So just as a quick word on what a case control study is, it's a relatively unique way of looking at a group of patients like this. And the way that case control studies work is it's very different in that you start with the outcome. Typically, when we're looking at observational studies or even interventional studies, what we do with it is we start with groups and we split them based on whether they were exposed or not. So as whether you maybe got a medication or a placebo, that's the exposure difference, or whether there was something in the environment or something that you do behaviorally that's different. That's what puts you into different groups. That is different in case control studies is you actually start with the outcome of interest, and you split your subjects into groups depending upon whether or not they have the outcome of interest. And then you look backwards to see the difference in exposures between those groups. So fairly unique, but can give you a good understanding, a good idea of what is driving the outcome of interest that put these people in into one group or another. And with this, the results that you get, because it's a little bit artificial in case control studies about how you group these individuals, how you collect this group of subjects, is that you have trouble determining classic things like prevalence and incidence, but you can get a comparison. And because of the nature of the statistics, an odds ratio is what's generated. So we'll come back to the importance of that, but that's a very standard way of saying in a case control study, if you have the outcomes, the odds that you have a certain exposure is this many times greater than if you don't have the outcome. So we'll come back to that as we think about this here in a little bit. And the other thing to just touch on very briefly and to not go deeply into is the methods that are used here for determining the outcomes. And what is used in this paper is called group-based trajectory modeling. Now, I thought the authors did a really nice job of giving a good description of how that works. And we're not going to go into details here, but essentially the way that this works is when you're doing group-based trajectory modeling is that you try to understand over time the trajectory, so the path that different subjects may take. And you start with everybody in a single group. And then by using this methodology, you create new groups that fit the patterns that these individuals take over time with whatever outcome you are interested in. And you keep adding more and more groups until either you have groups that are too small to be meaningful because of how few individuals are in them, or adding new groups don't really help your predictive ability to capture that trajectory over time. So that's what group-based trajectory modeling is. Okay, so now we're going to go back into this paper now that we have those couple of ideas, just the basics of them, and we'll see where they fit in here. So as far as the methodology here, the first thing I want to do is, we've mentioned this multiple times, this the type 1 diabetes exchange or the T1D exchange. And so I thought it would be helpful just to know a little bit more about what that is, because it's really important to understand where your patients are coming from and how they might be different from the population as a whole. So Earl, can you just give us an overview of this T1D exchange, what that is, how this works, what information we know about the individuals that participate in this registry?
Sure. A little bit of history. I think for people who don't know, I think people will find very interesting, especially people who live in New York and the East Coast area. Everyone remembers Leona Helmsley. 6 months before she passed away in 2006, her great-granddaughter developed type 1 diabetes at the age of 7, as I recall. And after she passed away, there was quite a bit of money in a trust. And her grandson, his name is David Panzer, and other trustees decided to use this money for diabetes research. And at the time of her death, there was $6 billion in this trust. And what was decided with this trust was to start this type 1 diabetes exchange for exactly, as you note, a longitudinal look at diabetes in America. And it's all type 1 diabetes. I should point out, however, that this is type 1 diabetes at diabetes centers of excellence. So everything that we hear from the type 1 diabetes exchange may not really reflect what's happening in average America. It's just at these 80 or so centers of excellence. I will point out that originally we had 26,000 individuals with type 1 diabetes, half of them pediatric. At one point, I remember the number of people who had signed up, 35,000 people with type 1 diabetes. And the whole point was to look at all aspects of disease. Every 5 years, there was a very granular survey that looked at all aspects, all lab, everything that one could imagine in terms of type 1 diabetes and the things that were involved with it, including socioeconomic, education, and so forth. Yearly, there was a smaller survey, but we received data every year. The exchange ended in that current form in 2018. And that's actually important because that's right around the time CGM became quite important when Medicare was approving CGM. So that's why a lot of what we look at now is really prior to when CGM became the standard of care that it is now. We looked at complications, we looked at forms of therapy, everything one can imagine about type 1 diabetes was part of this trial.
Good, thanks. So that, I think that's really important because that helps us understand, just like Earl said, this may not be totally representative of the entire United States. And if we want to think about it with everything that they're often at the disposal, the resources that these centers of excellence have, these will often be the results that we are getting with the standard of care, with the best that we can provide individuals. And so often there's an assumption, and this may be the case here, that numbers, if we see trajectories or how many individuals are on trajectories that are not as ideal as we'd like them to be, that this may be even more frequent in other populations. All right. So as we think about this, so just a few words on some of the individuals who were involved, who participated here. So this was data from 47 of the 81 sites, and these were patients who were enrolled between September of 2010 and July of 2012. And as far as total numbers, there were 1,775 participants, ages ranging 18 to 30 at enrollment, and there was an average follow-up of 6 years for this group of individuals. So I think a couple of things that would be important for us to discuss as a group here. One thing, just a comment that I would have, that it's not totally clear here. The reason there with only 47 of the 81 sites is this was all of the sites that had the eligible individuals there, exactly where that number came from. And then also that total group, that population of the 1,775, if that was everyone who was eligible with some of the criteria that we'll look at here shortly, or if that number was a little bit different. So there wasn't an explicit comment on that. But I think something that would be a little bit more important to think about, and Ashok, I think you had raised this as we were looking through this article initially, is asking, should it actually have enrolled individuals younger than 18? So 18 is where we traditionally consider adulthood to start. But if we're really thinking about this as a transition period, is that some of those important changes will probably start to happen in adolescence. And could we be missing anything by somewhat artificially starting this at age 18? So Ashok, I didn't know if you wanted to expand a little bit more on some of your questions about that particular cutoff for inclusion.
Maybe on the first point, Chase. So it wasn't clear to me from the paper why 47 sites were selected and why we stopped at 1775. I didn't let it bother me too much because of the nature, and I sort of did some inference from the nature of their analysis. So they're essentially doing a kind of a cluster analysis, which is what this latent class trajectory modeling is based on, and clustering has become a pretty fashionable thing in many kinds of statistical analyses looking at the heterogeneity of diabetes. And to be able to cluster, you have to have everybody with certain variables. Otherwise, you don't get decent clusters. So perhaps a limiting factor was, in this case, the number of longitudinal tests, because the premise is that you have longitudinal follow-up. Therefore, you must have two or three follow-up A1Cs over a certain period of time or your clusters are not meaningful. So even though they don't explicitly say that, they do say that every person in the study had what they call three age-year-based time points. So maybe that was a factor. Otherwise, there is a bias of selectivity that's possible that's not made clear in the paper. In regard to the other issue about should they not have picked people younger than 18, because they're talking about adolescence to adulthood, and adolescence, you know, is not fixed at 18. Maybe Earl has a point of view on that.
As far as this point, my thinking is absolutely they should have, because that is where you see the biggest spike in terms of A1Cs, no matter in which time period you look. They looked at this between 2010, 2012, then they looked at it again in 2016. And it was actually in that younger adolescent group was the tip of that spike. So I would have included younger than 18. Why they didn't actually may be a point about why only 47 sites. And this may be the answer to all of this. And that is, if you recall what I said, sites were both pediatric and adult, and the cutoff on the pediatric was 18. And I think this just may have been a logistical issue about why 18 was picked and why there were only 47 sites. They didn't say it, but knowing how the exchange worked, I think that explains why we are seeing what we are.
So as we think about some of the other data that's included here, and Earl gave us a nice overview of the multitude of data that's included here. So as a part of this, there were baseline questionnaires, also chart data was reviewed. It really, I would say, extensive demographic characteristics, education level, income, insurance, smoking status, lots of clinical data. So the baseline and then year five, Earl mentioned those repeat analyses that were done to pull that data. We're looking at things like insulin pump use, CGM use, pregnancy status, BMI. And then just like Ashok mentioned, so that A1C had to be measured multiple times to be able to be included. So you had to at least have three age years for each participant. And we talked a little bit already about that trajectory modeling that was used. So that was the key analysis that was used here. And then once these individuals were put into these different trajectories, then looking back at the covariates that could affect that glycemic control were assessed. And that's also looking at where they're at baseline, but then also change from that time of enrollment to 5 years afterwards. So looking at age of diabetes onset, race and ethnicity data, looking at sex, CGM use, insulin delivery method, educational level, income, insurance, marital status and smoking status, frequency of blood sugar checks, BMI, total daily insulin dose, quite a few things were looked at. I do think it would be helpful. We always want to, when we think of all these things that were looked at, is try to take a good hard look and think about, well, what else could be helpful to know here? Either what information was available and was maybe just not included, or what information isn't available or just really hard to measure. Earl actually already mentioned something really important, mental health and the impact that can have. So that's already a potential thing that maybe we would want to know and either don't or just don't have a good way of assessing the information. Earl and Ashok, any other information that you can think of, particularly these covariates, something else that could affect the trajectory that we might want to know that we don't have here?
Yeah, I'll start. I think mental health is the big one. Well, you could say in all age groups, but especially this age group. Here at the University of Washington, we have an adolescent young adult transition clinic. And I have to say the mental health issues seem to be the primary issue in terms of how this population does. Associated with that, but not completely 100% associated with this, is alcohol and recreational drug use, which is extremely important, which I think needs to be considered when looking at this population.
I agree, Earl. And there's another thing which I think may be particularly vexing in the United States. It kind of falls into the category of insurance status, but it's a unique aspect of insurance status. If you live in states like Texas, where through CHIP and other agencies, you know, children are covered until the age of 18, and then you move past your 18th birthday and the state has absolutely no Medicaid coverage for anybody beyond that age, except in very dire circumstances, you immediately fall into a very deep hole. And it's very unfortunate that, you know, many, many children with autoimmune type 1 diabetes, their first adult visit is usually a year or two later, and it's usually in the emergency room with DKA. And that's not exactly the same as insurance status. It means you had it and you had a certain lifestyle and follow-up and then you had nothing. So it's a complete lack of insurance transition, if you like, or some kind of care transition.
Yeah, we don't have it that way here in Washington State. Yeah. But the issue is, once they turn 18, 19, whether they go to college or not, if they do need to get on some sort of public assistance, it's actually getting them to that point.
Yes.
Once they get to that point, we actually can do pretty well with them in our system. Because with our state Medicaid, for example, we can usually get them CGM. That's not true in all states, but it's just getting them to that point. But then it brings up another really important point, which I think will also come up later. It depends who the provider is and the resources of that provider, the infrastructure in that provider's office. I mean, all of this is extremely variable. I mean, We're looking here at the study for the T1D exchange, but we know that in the non-pediatric situation, approximately half of all with type 1 diabetes in the U.S. are not seen by an endocrinologist. They're seen by a family practice physician, an internist, maybe a gynecologist for primary care, but it's somebody who doesn't have the infrastructure or the knowledge to really be able to give state-of-the-art diabetes care. And I think that's incredibly important.
Good. So just one final word before we move on from the method, things to be thinking about. And as that's when we look at some of the data that's going to be reported here, comparing these different trajectory groups, looking at the key characteristics that they compare between each group. And the authors present both the adjusted and the unadjusted results for these baseline characteristics. And I think that it's helpful that this is included, and I always like to mention this as a helpful thing to look at. It helps you understand, when you can compare both of these results, the impact of what's called residual confounding. So when you do these adjustments, is to try to understand the impact of some of these other characteristics. They're going to be interrelated. They confound one another. And when you measure them and when you can include them in this analysis, it helps remove that effect. And so whenever you see unadjusted results that may be particularly high. So in this case, we're going to be looking at an odds ratio. So if you see an odds ratio that's particularly high number, but then after you do adjustment, that number drops fairly dramatically, that makes you worried about the possibility of residual confounding. So there's no hard and fast numbers here, but say if you found some very high number, something was associated with a 10 to 20 time risk of something, and then it drops to say something fairly small, 1.5 or 2, just to make those up as examples, you would be worried about any confounding that wasn't accounted for, that if it had been, if it could be, that may actually remove the difference entirely. So it's always nice. Authors don't always do that, but they did here. And so I think that's a nice feature of this paper. And one other thing that is helpful to keep in mind is the idea of using an odds ratio. Whenever we think about the risk of one group compared to another, our brains are fairly hardwired to think about it as a relative risk. And that's a much more natural way of thinking about it. Odds ratios are a little bit unusual, and they're harder for us to think about that. And typically, when authors have the option, when their statistics would allow it, relative risk is preferred because it's a much more natural way for readers to think about that risk. Many times, that can't be done. Case control studies, you have to use an odds ratio because of the way that the study is constructed. And so while it's still appropriate to use that, I think it's helpful to know that that number can be a little bit different. And almost always when you compare the odds ratio and the relative risk, the odds ratio, the number itself is larger. And so in our heads, it can inflate the impact there. So nothing, again, that the authors did incorrectly. They did it just like they should here, but an important factor to keep in mind. So now that we've taken a good close look at the methodology here, we're going to walk through the results and understand these different trajectories and then some of the factors that are associated with these different groups. So Ashok, why don't you walk us through the author's results?
Sure, Chase. So, just to get back to the key aspect of the study design, the idea was to come across, to define distinct trajectories of A1C change over time, how many groups there were, what were the distinct trajectories, and then to look at characteristics compared between those different groups to see what might have determined that particular trajectory. So starting with some key demographics, there was a slight favor of women in this group, 54% female, was predominantly white, 86% white, about 58% had a high school diploma, about a third had a college degree, and there was a very wide range of income. Interestingly, as Earl mentioned, this was kind of the dawn of using pumps or using CGMs, and it was fairly extensive use. 71% had used an insulin pump at some time during the study period, and about a third had used continuous glucose monitoring as well. And just a quick side note, Earl, is that fairly typical for type 1 patients in clinics around the U.S. right now, that frequency of pump and CGM?
Not at all, especially if you go back to the time. What's been very interesting is that the use of pumps has been very stable between 30 and 33% of type 1. So here we are double that, which I find very interesting. And CGM use at this time nationally was much, much lower than this, but it's just been exponentially increasing by the year, by the month. And especially during COVID, we've seen an explosion of CGM, but this is much more use of technology than we see in the general type 1 adult population, even at this age group down to 18.
I think that's always one of the important questions that you want to ask yourself as a reader when you're looking at this, and usually this is in table one. You want to look at some of these numbers and say, how similar are these patients to the patients that I see? And if you work in an academic center, one of these type 1 diabetes exchange locations or similar setup, you can say this actually may look very similar to the patients that I see. And so the results may be fairly applicable. But if it's not, if it's one of these other locations and you're looking at this, I think it's important to know this is not necessarily going to be representative of what would be seen in the population of patients that I care for if a similar study were to be done. So I think this is exactly how you want to be thinking about this sort of information when you review it.
Right. And not only is it different in different parts of the United States and different populations, but as Earl pointed out, there's a dramatic change in the usage of these technologies. And since that's one of the key covariates, and we'll see in a minute that those covariates are actually affecting the outcomes, we can expect that some of the conclusions of this paper are themselves dynamic. They're going to change as usage of these technologies changes. But anyway, let me get into the main findings. So it turned out that in terms of the statistical cluster analysis, there were five distinct trajectories in this population of patients. And I'll try to describe them. The first was people who started off at a low A1C, about 7-ish, and they declined over time. So they started off pretty good and they got even better over the time of the study. The second group was kind of like the first group, but a little bit worse at start. They were more like A1C of 8-ish at the start, but they also came down over time and then met with group 1 by the time they hit 30. Then the third group was high, A1C at about 9, and flat. So they started off high and they stayed high throughout the entire period of the study. The fourth group started off very high, A1C for around 11, but they did decline over the time of the study. They declined rather rapidly, but only came down to about 9 and then plateaued at about 9. And the fourth group was also very high, starting at an A1C of about 11, and declined more gradually, ending up with group 4 at about 9. So again, excellent, getting better, not so excellent, getting better, staying very flat, not very good, coming down rapidly, not very good, coming down slowly. So those are the sort of the five different trajectories. And it's interesting that the groups 1 and 2, the ones that started off pretty well and did even better, seem to achieve ADA goals pretty nicely. It's about 3/4 of group 1 made it to an A1C of less than 7 by the age of 30, and about 20% of group 2 made it to an A1C of about less than 7% by the age of 30. So those are your five groups. Now, what are the major correlations of the key characteristics? And obviously, there's a ton of correlations you can do, but I'm going to stick to the one or two key ones that bring the message. So the first correlation was between the two very good groups versus the group that stayed not so good and flat, right? So that was quite helpful. The second major comparison was between the two groups that did really well all through and the two groups that started off very high and then plateaued at about 9. So those are the two kinds of comparisons that seem most helpful in kind of delineating these key differences and predictors, if you like, or features that distinguish them. So in terms of comparing groups 1 and 2 against the group that didn't change, group 3, the differences were that the groups that 1 and 2 were more likely to be male, more likely to be older at the onset of their diabetes, have a higher education level, have be non-smokers. They would check their home monitoring of blood glucose more frequently. They were white predominantly, and they had a lower insulin dose at the time of enrollment. They had private insurance. They also were correlated with getting married or staying married, and if they were women, also with getting pregnant. So it's an interesting group of differences. Just keep that in mind for a second. The second major comparison, which was to look at groups 1 and 2 against 4 and 5, okay, the ones that started off low and got better versus the two that started off very high and got somewhat better. Again, the big differences were that the groups 1 and 2 were more likely to be male, have a higher education level, use an insulin pump, not smoke, do more frequent blood glucose checks at home, be white, have a lower insulin dose at enrollment, and have private insurance. Finally, another small tweaky comparison. Remember, the top two groups started off very high. One declined rapidly, one declined more slowly. The big difference between those two groups is that the group that declined rapidly, that group tended to do more fingertip glucose checks at home and started off somewhat leaner than the slow declining group. So I'll stop at this point. All of the comparisons so far that I've talked about had to do with adjustments for the covariates. There were a couple of changes that were only apparent when you didn't adjust for the covariates. And one of them was actually about continuous glucose monitoring. So the CGM use only became significant before adjustment. And very interestingly, pump use was not significant, either adjusted or unadjusted, comparing the excellent group to the steady group. Earl, I'd like to ask you what you think about these two factors, considering how much we're pushing the use of pumps and CGM.
Not surprised at all. There was a wonderful meta-analysis published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2012, and it actually showed no difference between pump therapy and multiple injection therapy in type 1 diabetes. It turned out there was maybe a tiny improvement with pump, but that was all based on one study, and you take that one study out of the meta-analysis, there was no difference. CGM, on the other hand, and I think there have been other studies more recently that have shown this. There was a relatively large one last year that showed that whether you look at MDI or pump patients, it's really the CGM that is the more important tool. And of course, now what's happening, which is obviously not part of the study, is merging these two technologies together for automated insulin delivery. And I think over the next 5 to 10 years, that's going to be the more interesting thing to see what happens with these high A1C patients as they have more access to this technology. But this was in the very early days of CGM. And I should point out that the SMBG data has been shown over and over, including by the T1D exchange group. The people who do more checking, no matter the age group, turns out to have the better hemoglobin A1C. So I'm absolutely not surprised by these results at all.
What about just the trajectories themselves, Earl? It's nice to see the statistical, analysis, but how does this compare with your gestalt of what actually happens to many patients during this transition period?
I've thought a lot about this, and I've been doing this a long time, as you both know, and I've never thought about it in these sort of absolute terms with trajectory, but once I read the paper and I thought about doing this for 35, almost 40 years, this really is sort of what we do see. And I do think that the socioeconomic situation, the culture, the family acceptance, we haven't talked much about family, especially in these younger people, and family support. And later on, spouse support and general family support. These are so important. What we typically see, for example, in pregnancy, we see the husband, the partner, so involved with the care. And then we see differences in the trajectory if the partner is not involved after the pregnancy or the partner is involved after the pregnancy. And that goes hand in hand to what we see here. So I would say that what this showed, when I look at that figure one and I look at the trajectories here, this is sort of put into one picture what I've seen over the last four decades.
And I think what Earl says really nicely gives an illustration of it's not always easy exactly what causes these things. So there are certain things that are measured. So just potentially as an example, change in insurance. And we heard a few different examples of what could trigger that. It could just be aging out of a certain insurance system. But it could be some of these other things that have been mentioned as well. So maybe what change in insurance meant was that your job status changed, or that as a part of that, you maybe moved out of the house. And so your family support system changed pretty dramatically. So I do think we need to be careful as we think about all these different really important factors, is it's not necessarily immediately the cause of these trajectories that we're seeing. They are associated, and I think this information gets us closer to understanding what those associations are, but it's not always a one-to-one correlation of this change happened, and so that must be exactly why somebody ended up on a trajectory.
That's a very important point you make, Chase. Nevertheless, this is often the best we can do with clinical data. And it's important to obviously make sure that the associations are completely spurious or not. But if you believe them, then I think it's worthwhile to think of them as potentially predictive. I mean, that's the whole point of the exercise. I mean, Earl has said he has seen these trajectories in his patients. So why do the study? Well, what the study is doing is saying that seeing these trajectories and giving you the risk factors for being on one or another trajectory, hopefully you can catch these people at 16, 17, or 18, figure out what are the characteristics of that point, and try to modify the ones potentially that will keep them on the best possible trajectory, right? I mean, that is the whole intent behind this thing. And so coming to that, Earl, which one of these factors they've talked about, you know, in these two major comparisons are in fact modifiable? And they may be theoretically modifiable, but are they actually modifiable in real life? What do you think?
Well, there are some that are. I mean, I'm sort of really intrigued by the higher insulin dose and how much of that is insulin resistance, how much of that is related to the fact that they're just asking for more insulin for their insurance, for example. I mean, we've seen over and over again that patients say they're taking a certain amount of insulin, but they're missing so much. So let's just delve into that a little bit here, Ashok, because I think this is a really important point. I can tell you, for most people with A1Cs in double digits, even above 9% with type 1 diabetes, and I learned this from a mentor who I learned so much from, and that was Dr. Julio Santiago. And what Julio taught me was, if you have an A1C over 9%, you're missing insulin. So if we just accept that for a moment, and that's not always the case, obviously, but if we look at these group 4 and 5 patients and they're missing insulin, and as they get older and their brains mature and they realize it's important, or maybe they develop a little retinopathy, there's all kinds of things we haven't talked about. Now they start taking their insulin as they knew they were supposed to, or maybe they get married and the spouse is part of the equation. I mean, there are all these things that we can't measure well. But the other thing here, especially with a lot of our African-American patients and other minorities, here in Seattle, for example, I have a few Koreans and African-Americans and Native Americans. It's rare, but we do see type 1 diabetes, but they are more insulin resistant. And to your question, what can we do about these people who have a genetic predisposition to more insulin resistance? Well, what about good old-fashioned exercise? I mean, I talk about exercise as a prescription with so many of my patients. I don't think we do that enough in type 1 diabetes, but it is something that is modifiable. We've had wonderful weather. The bikers, the joggers, the walkers, they've become a traffic hazard right now, which in some respects is a good thing. But there are things that we can modify with some of these high A1C patients.
Good. And so what we're going to do, we'll give you a few of our other thoughts here shortly. But I think as we transition more into the authors' discussion and conclusion, let's start by just summarizing some of the conclusions that the authors made here. And then we'll look a bit more of these potential implications. And we'll think about, okay, should this change our clinical practice? What can we take from this? Or what would we say? Well, I think we need more data before we make any changes in what we do. So first, what the authors said. So as Ashok really nicely walked us through, so there were really 5 trajectories that were identified, at least in this population of subjects. And the authors say that there are demographic and clinical variables that affect each of these trajectories. I might quibble with that just a bit and say, well, I'd say that's associated with, for the reason I mentioned before, we don't always know exactly what's driving, if it's truly affecting it, but they're certainly associated here. And an important transition or an important pattern that's seen in this transition period is that 4 of these 5 groups actually show an improvement over time. And while none of these groups had an average A1C that was at goal at baseline, 2 of these, so 69% of this cohort, did reach goal eventually. And Earl has already walked us through nicely that this is certainly consistent with the patients that he sees. And I think a few things that we also want to be thinking about here, as far as interesting or maybe unexpected findings, depending on how you want to describe that, and the authors point this out in their discussion, is a couple of things that were associated with better A1C control that the authors pointed out. So that being male sex and then also pregnancy. So I thought that having Earl and Ashok both give us their thoughts on that, kind of why that was seen, what might be going on there, would be a worthwhile discussion.
I will just start what I think is really important to understand, and I haven't seen a recent study looking at this, but intentional insulin withholding in women, I know it still happens. Now we see insulin rationing, which is a whole other different topic due to the cost of insulin. But if we take that out of this picture for a moment, I know we see insulin withholding in women due to part of complex eating disorders. So that may be why the male gender did show associated with better A1C and certainly pregnancy. You know, there was a paper done by Steve Gabby when he was here at the University of Washington that showed that whatever A1C a woman had prior to pregnancy before trying for conception, after the pregnancy, they ended up right back where they started, even though their A1Cs during pregnancy were all superb. And I think that also needs to be thought about when we look at these data.
I would say just purely playing devil's advocate on here and ignoring any other data that's out there, I think this would illustrate particularly the pregnancy issue is that it can often be hard to tease out cause versus effect, because you could argue, well, potentially it's the either wanting to get pregnant and so that was the motivation for improving control, or once you became pregnant, using that as motivation for improved control. You could also argue here that, well, maybe it was somebody obtained better control and that increased fertility. So it can often be hard these observational studies really trying to tease out cause versus effect, though you interpret that in a larger body of evidence to try to come up with what you think is the most plausible explanation for these changes that are seen here. One other comment that the authors make that I thought would be helpful for us to think about is that they have a hypothesis about this better trajectories that are seen if the diabetes was late onset. So they have some different ideas. And Ashok, I know you had pointed this out as an interesting idea about their proposal of why this might happen. So why don't you give us your thoughts and why this might be the case, and if you think the data support what the authors concluded here.
I think the caveat here is that all speculating on the basis of clinical data. But I think that one thinks, or one would like to believe, that being later in onset means that you had a better reserve of beta cell function when you started. And therefore, over the same period of time, you started off at a higher level, and therefore whatever decline happens as a result of the autoimmunity and other factors, you were just better off most of the time in terms of the amount of beta cell function. So I think it really points to the incredible importance, and here we're not speculating, of beta cell reserve as a very key factor in overall A1C control. With all other things being equal, you know, having beta cell functional reserve, even if you are a longstanding autoimmune type 1 diabetic patient, helps in better control and presumably helps, you know, with longevity of good control. If I could just comment on one factor related to that, the other thing that was interesting was the association of a better outcome with people with lower insulin requirement at baseline. My own speculation there is that it's kind of a surrogate for insulin sensitivity. Right. And my colleague, Maria Redondo, amongst others, has done a wonderful job of showing in our very heterogeneous population of pediatric diabetes here down in Houston, where, you know, we are really multi-ethnic in every kind of diabetes, including autoimmune type 1 diabetes, is that the obesity added on to the autoimmunity plays a really sort of a double whammy in terms of some very hard outcomes, glycemic control, of course, but even C-peptide, reserve over time. So I think it's almost an extra factor. Therefore, if you were leaner, more insulin sensitive, later in onset, all that added up to less insulin at baseline. That was the marker. And then, you know, one did better over time. So I think it's mostly a reflection of better beta cell reserve. But Earl, I wonder what you think.
So it's hard to argue with biology because you're right. But I think it's more complicated than that.
Sure.
Because when young children develop their type 1, there's more time for psychological burdens to develop. These children and then later adolescents, they feel alone. They feel different from their family members. They feel different from their peers at school. And there's just a lot of pent up psychological burden, for lack of a better term, that also I think is not a good thing when it comes to their overall control. And my guess at the end of the day is that both of these factors, these biological factors and these psychological factors, play a role in terms of what we see.
And as you mentioned, they had not used psychological factors or mental health as a covariate. So that's completely missing from the analysis.
And so before we get to the final step of thinking about whether this should change your practice or not. Earl, one more question for you. You said that this actually fits with the trajectories that you see of the patients that you care for. Help us put this in the context, though, of other research that's out there. Do you think that this fits with the large amount of observational studies that are out there, or are there some outlying features that maybe we need to think about a little bit more that don't fit with what we know about this transition period? How would you describe how this goes along with the rest to the medical literature?
It's hard to compare this because this was so unique. My favorite comparison is a study published about a year and a half ago by Jeremy Pettis. They didn't look at these sorts of trajectories just in this age group. They actually went down to age 15. But what they did was they looked at type 1 diabetes and the T1D exchange compared to another very large patient registry in the U.S., and what was shown was that at every age group, A1C levels were higher outside of the T1D exchange in a general non-T1D exchange clinic. And every outcome was worse. I remember, I quote this to the fellows here all the time, if you are outside of a T1D exchange clinic and you have an A1C of 9% or above, your risk of DKA is 16% per year. Think of that. 16% per year. And this really bothers me, and it continues to bother me. I actually do think that we have so much variability in our management of type 1 diabetes. And what we are seeing is, despite the fact that this is a relatively large sample size, we are seeing a very small group of people compared to the US or even bigger globally, what happens with type 1 diabetes. And I should point out, what we are seeing in this paper is the best case scenario for type 1 diabetes right now. It doesn't get better than this. And that, to me, if I put on my epidemiologist hat, I actually don't have one of those hats. But if I did have one of those hats, that's what would concern me the most.
So what I do want you to keep that hat on, or at least the hat on, from thinking about this from a big picture perspective, because I want us to end with where the authors conclude. And they say, well, if we know all this information, then we can potentially take this and build predictive models. And so they said that could be helpful both at a clinical level, which I would imply from that would mean more on a one-on-one level, meaning me as a provider and the patient who's in front of me, but also the public health level. So a much larger level to try to help understand things. And they say, if we do that, then actually we can create systems, we can implement changes, to use their words, that will likely reduce the diabetes-related burden of disease and cost related to complications over time. So I want us to think critically, if we can, just about that, and really with just the question of, do we think that we're there now? So we have this very unique and helpful analysis of the data that's out there. Do we think that's enough? Or do we think, no, we probably need more data before we can really start moving towards any such predictive model that would be clinically actionable? So Earl, I will start with you, since I've asked you to keep that big picture hat on. So do you think we're there yet, or probably need more information before we could start thinking about such a system?
Well, I can tell you that as one of the T1D exchange investigators and seeing these patients and thinking about this for many years now, these people who are in groups 4 and 5, almost all of them need some sort of additional help, either mental health, they need help with economically trying to afford what they need, but they're not there because they want to be there. And the biggest thing not addressed by the authors is the psychological help. We are very blessed here in Seattle, very fortunate that we have both a psychologist and a psychiatrist on site in our clinic. And I'm not sure how we would do without that. And I think about the average endocrinologist in practice or the general internist, everyone wanting to do the best for their patients. They don't have access, or at least they don't have easy access to the mental health and to the social work to get patients the technology, the insulin, whatever it is, because it is hard work. It is hard work getting everybody everything that they need. And so I think there's really two big issues for these high A1C populations that at least I take care of. There's the mental health help that is needed, and then there's just the help dealing with our dysfunctional system, getting people everything they need. Because I would say the vast majority of people in groups 4 and 5, that's what they need based on my experience.
So I share Earl's, I think, calculated cynicism, if I could put it that way, in regard to what's happening. Because if Seattle is the upper end of the spectrum for diabetes care, I would say Houston is not the other end of the spectrum, but just a glaring paradox. Because on the one hand, in our private setting, we have amazing care of the kind that Earl is talking about. And we also have an enormous number of people, those at the lower end of the income scale, who get nothing when they start becoming adults. And the transition, although we've tried mightily in many areas, is most feasible in the private setting when you have a continuity of insurance, when you have a continuity of family support, when you have a continuity of psychological support. And it does not work when you don't have those things. So unfortunately, we have, you know, a real life experiment of watching these things happen. So it comes back to, does this favor help us? Do these outcomes help us? But I think if you had all of those support situations where you could actually modify what's modifiable, then it works. If you're not able to modify it, then it's simply frustrating to know that this happens. Right? I hate to end on a cynical note, but I must say that there are things about our political and social landscape that make the management of type 1 diabetes incredibly hard.
So Earl, maybe we'll end with you here, kind of thinking about changing our practice. We talked about potentially a lot of information that can be used to change things at a larger level. But when we do think about it on that one-on-one, that providing care to the individual patients that we see, what, if anything, do you think that you could take from this paper that would have the potential to change the care that you would provide to your patients?
It's a really important question, Chase. I think the way we manage type 1 diabetes in adults is far different than what happens in the pediatric clinics around the country. And let's just think about this. 95% or so of children with type 1 diabetes get their care in a pediatric clinic like at Vanderbilt or Baylor or the University of Washington. On the adult side, it's one-on-one for the majority of patients, and there's no team approach. And there needs to be a team. There needs to be access to a psychologist. There needs to be access to a social worker. I actually have been using social workers quite a bit the last few weeks because not everybody has the benefit of having resources. And I should also point out, we didn't talk about it at all. It was not the population, but all of the different issues that occur with these high A1C patients in our Medicare patients with type 1 diabetes. And that's a whole other discussion that we have not really scratched the surface with, where, again, we need this. I think that as providers, we have to be open to talking to patients about psychological and social needs. And that includes if they can afford their insulin. You would be surprised. I'm surprised because I bring it up all the time. Can you afford your insulin? And the number of times I've literally had people break down into tears over the years because they can't and they're embarrassed to talk about it. These are things that I think we as physicians, no matter where you practice, you can do because we can get people insulin. All three of the insulin companies have access to this. But I think to really answer your question head on, I feel the way we do type 1 diabetes in the United States on the adult side is lacking, because it needs a team approach. We try to do it one-on-one the same way we treat other conditions. And I don't think, without the data to support it, I don't think we do it right. What we do in our diabetes clinic here is different than what happens with a general endocrinologist in the community. But I've thought a lot about it. And certainly, if I had anybody ask me from another city, where should I get my care, and they're an adult, I will always tell them, go to a clinic that does diabetes therapy where you have access to an entire team of nutritionists, social workers, psychologists, nurses, pharmacists, because that is where I think you will get the best care. The unfortunate reality is that's only available to a few people.
And with that, I would like to thank Ashok Balasubramanian and Earl Hirsch for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did and look forward to you all joining us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.